We're talking about predatory lending and farm debt here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The economic trend lines show a long-term decline in farm income that has forced some farmers to default on their loans. And at the same time, banks that specialize in ag credit have tightened their lending standards as the economic situation becomes more grim. Farmers are estimated to hold nearly $427 billion in debt this year. That's the most since the 80s farm crisis. Farmers, what is the hardest part about managing your debt? Are you worried you may sell off your cattle or have to sell the family farm? We're at 800-642-1234 to join in. Frank Fryer is an economic specialist with Wisconsin's Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. He works in financial consulting and farm succession planning. Frank, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks so much for joining us. Can you explain what are these unregulated predatory lenders? What do they look like?
Well, they look like the old statement, if it appears too good to be true, it probably is. So you're reading a farm magazine or a newspaper and you see an ad that says, fill out this ad, a one page, email it, send it in, call it in, and tomorrow morning you're eligible for $200,000 of debt. So if it isn't regular, we look at the lenders that farmers or anybody borrowing money should look at are regulated. Banks are regulated by the Wisconsin Department of Financial Institutions. Some banks are federal, they're chartered, they're rated by FDIC. Farm credit is regulated by FCA, and Farm Service Agency, FSA, is a part of the federal government, so they are heavily regulated. There are some supply companies that offer lenders that you know the local people, and you're filling out regular applications. But just filling out a simple application, making a phone call, and either getting a credit card or getting a line of credit is risky because those lenders may not have any regulatory rules to follow.
Frank, how much of a problem is this? How often do you get calls from farmers who have taken out these loans from unregulated lenders?
Well, the unfortunate part is we usually get the call after the loan is taken out and then it's time to pay back, and the farmer can't pay back or they can't pay back on the terms of the loan. And they call and say, we got a problem. And some of these lenders operate out of state. They're hard to get a hold of. They make sure they're hard to get a hold of. The best time if you see that kind of an ad is, again, go back to the old adage, if it appears too good to be true, it probably is. And then maybe go to your local lender and ask them, are you aware of this lender? They can call the Wisconsin Department of Ag, our farm center, at our 800 number, and we will do some research to see if it's a legitimate lender. We will actually call the lender and ask some questions, but many times they're hard to get a hold of. Everything flows out, and it's hard to get anything to flow in.
We're talking with Frank Fryer. He is an economic specialist with Wisconsin's Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, where he's focused on financial consulting and farm succession planning. There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. As we look at this farm debt and lending, have you taken out a loan from an organization separate from your bank? What kind of interest rates are you seeing? How are you dealing with it? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Frank, may I ask, how did we get here? What is the situation like for farmers right now? What is causing, driving them to these types of lenders?
Well, I think the big factor is a word that I think has become important in our vocabulary, and that's uncertainty. Right now, if we look at the farm situation, prices are uncertain. Input costs are uncertain. We have trade wars going on. They're uncertain. Agriculture has always had some volatility. And then you add the weather. This spring has got to be one of the worst springs that we've had as far as planting, as far as trying to do any, make first crop hay. So all that uncertainty, people panic, they may not have a loan approved. They may not even have applied for a loan. And so then they see this as a grasp of saying, aha, I can get this loan, I can get the money, I can plant a crop, and then we'll see where we go from there.
Because you need the money in order to plant the crop. You need that capital on the front end so that you're able to get that crop in the ground and then get the dividends when it's harvested.
And I think part of it is people panic. If you drive by a farm and there's nothing planted, you have a couple of thoughts. One, maybe they couldn't get credit. Maybe they've rented it out and their neighbor hasn't planted it. Maybe it's the weather. But we're all proud people. None of us want to say that we have failed or we can't get a loan or we're going to have to exit farming. So if you can put that off even until the fall, then you worry about paying it back. That's why some of this is happening.
So how does all of this uncertainty affect how banks feel about lending right now? The banks who offer ag credit, how are they feeling in terms of securing loans for farmers?
I think all lenders have tightened their credit a little. And sometimes when people ask me that, I say, no, I don't think the credit standards have changed any. They're just using the standards they have within the bank. When things were good, the prices were good, the weather was good, it was easy to lend money and say, well, maybe they ought to have this certain percent equity or this kind of working capital, but things are going well, we can take that risk. Right now, we've had nonprofit in agriculture since 2014. You go 5 years, there's money to be paid back. Some people have not been able to pay back in any 1 year. All of the money they've borrowed, they put more of that debt over on the long term. And so there's not the options to take care of this debt that we used to have.
Well, besides the crops, how are farmers keeping their equipment going, their combines, their tractors, and all of the technology that's on farms these days?
Well, I talked to a farmer last night that said, and I would say he's a very good farmer, good manager. He's a dairy operation and also has some crops. He said, we used to trade certain machinery every 3 years, hay binds, big package balers, TMRs, manure spreaders. And now he said, I'm out to 6-7 years. They're starting to cost me money in repair bills, but I simply cannot afford to go in and buy a new piece of machinery.
So that farmer is going on 6 to 7 years on particular equipment to run the farm versus in the past 3 years might have been the cycle.
So then you have breakdowns that you didn't plan on. Repairs are costly. Parts are costly. Plus, that just stretches out your workload. So now you've got more work. You're trying to fix a piece of machinery. You're trying to locate the parts. You're trying to figure out how to fix it. In the meantime, if you've got money borrowed, interest is piling up. Malprices has increased in the last couple of weeks, last couple of months. But if you're getting $18 a hundredweight or you're getting 20 with premium and it's costing you 25 to produce it, it's still not enough.
Frank Fryer is an economic specialist with Wisconsin's Consumer Protection Agency. Did you end up turning to a predatory lender but only realized it after the fact? What happened? Where do you stand with your farm debt now? And how are you staying afloat? Are you burning through equity? Is that affecting your health? Join in this discussion. Share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. Back in just a moment with more conversation right here on the Ideas Network. We're looking at predatory lending on the farm. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. During the first quarter of this year, the default rate for farm loans held by banks hit its highest level in 7 years. And as commodity prices fall and farming becomes less profitable, producers are depending on non-farm income to stay afloat and service their debt. Or they may try to turn to new loans from companies that are not regulated by state or federal financial agencies. So how is your farm's balance sheet right now? Are you putting off equipment purchases like a combine, like a baler? Are you struggling to purchase feed for cattle, or are you relying on equity? Have you left farming altogether? Join in with your story, your questions about unregulated lenders at 800-642-1234. Frank Fryer stays with us. He's an economic specialist with Wisconsin's Consumer Protection Agency. Frank, many farmers across the state didn't get their fields to plant their crops due to the wet weather we've been seeing, the cooler temperatures we saw this spring. How does this factor in when you look at the financial situation, what the weather impact is, what a hailstorm means to a farmer?
Well, the weather impact is another one of those uncertainties. It has a major impact. Take, for example, first crop hay. We're a dairy state. First crop hay is a very important part of our ration for dairy cattle. And we have people who have tried cutting hay. Maybe they hit a window and they got two good days of hay and good quality hay. The next 3-4 weeks, every time they mowed hay, it's rained. So now they've got hay that's been rained on 2 or 3 times. They call that heifer hay, and it doesn't fit the quality they need for their dairy cows. Some people are simply waiting, and the hay is way past maturity. Usually in a good year, they'd be cutting their second crop of hay right now, and some people are still on their first crop. People are desperate for feed, and they ended up the winter short of feed. Feed became high priced. Now we're heading into the summer, so feed quality, lack of enough feed, how will they get through the next winter? They don't have the money to go out and buy feed. They've already invested money in fertilizer. They've invested money in the harvesting cost. It's a major impact, and we receive calls, maybe not every day, but surely we receive calls every week from people saying, what do we do? We're out of feed. The feed quality of what we just made is terrible. We're thinking about selling our dairy cows.
And Frank, what do you tell them when they say, I'm at that point, I think I'm going to sell my cattle?
Well, the first thing we tell them is, let's pause for a minute. Let's step back and look at the whole picture. We're here to help you. That's the purpose of the Farm Center. Let us look at your financials. Let us evaluate them and give you a third-party, neutral, objective of analysis, and let's talk about this, because selling your cattle and saying, well, I'm just going to go ahead and sell them, well, then you got income tax problems. You may sell your cattle. Your lender may say they want all the money. Now it comes time to file your tax return, and you can't pay the taxes. So we tell people, pause. Let us help you. Work with your local lender. They're on your side also. They may have told you no, they can't lend you more money, but they want to see you, if you're going to exit farming, to do it in the most profitable manner. So it's set back, don't panic, and let's see how we can work through this.
Are you talking with farmers who are also trying to hold down jobs off the farm to increase their income, part-time jobs, perhaps even full-time jobs off the farm to keep the farm afloat?
And we do have people that are doing that. I don't know how they're able to keep up very long. They're burning both ends of the candle. They're milking cows. Maybe they've cut back their herd a little bit. Maybe they have family help, part-time family help, or they have kids that can do it in morning or nights right now, being out of school. So there's people doing everything they can to try to generate more income. Maybe one of the spouses says, okay, I need to take a job off the farm. We need that job for our health insurance. If we can get that benefit, we need that job to infuse some more capital or more funds into our financial situation. So, yes, we have all of those going on.
Talking with Frank Fryer, he is an economic specialist with Wisconsin's Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, where he's focused on financial consulting, farm succession planning, and helping family farms stay afloat in difficult economic times. You can join in with your situation, your farming situation, 800-642-1234. How are you looking at your balance sheets right now? Have you thought about selling cattle? Did you go through this process already? And what is that financial situation doing to your health? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Frank, what about filing for bankruptcy? Is that ever an option, a good option for farmers?
Well, we just got done talking about the scenario of the farmer that says, I'm going to sell my cows, and we say, let's pause and let's look at the whole big picture. One of the options that comes up in that whole big picture is bankruptcy, and there is a chapter of the bankruptcy law called Chapter 12 that was written in the 1980s when we had farm financial crisis, and that's an option they have. What does the Chapter 12 bankruptcy do? Talking to one of the leading bankruptcy attorneys in the state, he said, well, he looks at the big picture of bankruptcy and says it's a way of restructuring your debt. It's a way of reducing, maybe in some cases, reducing the debt, restructuring the debt, setting some terms. Maybe it's lowering your interest rate. And so Chapter 12 bankruptcy is an option. And I tell people it's not a fun option. Occasionally we get a call, somebody will say, oh, I'll just file Chapter 12 and take care of all my problems. I compare a Chapter 12 bankruptcy to your doctor telling you you have cancer. You don't treat it till you have it, so you don't file bankruptcy till you can't find any other option, and you don't treat cancer until you know that you have it. They're both painful, and Chapter 12 bankruptcy is definitely an option, but it should not be taken lightly.
As part of your work, you also get calls from farmers who are depressed and who say that they have suicidal thoughts. How often are you getting those kinds of calls, and what do you say?
Well, we're definitely getting more of those kind of calls than we have for quite a while. And sometimes what do we say? Sometimes we say, we listen. They tell us maybe after an hour, by the fact you listened, that's helped us a lot. That's helped let us move forward. If we need more than active listening, if we need to be asking questions, we try to find out what's going on. How do they want to commit suicide? That gives us some idea how serious they are. And we try to then find out, are there family members that we can talk to and involve in helping? Are there neighbors? Who can we help them turn to? And they can call us. We'll do the best job of listening that we can, but we also need to have somebody at a local level who is also on their side. And so we do everything we can to help people work through that, to see that there are options, that it's not as bad as it looks, even if it does look bleak. Let's work through this. What's the impact of bankruptcy on your family? So we do our best job of trying to help these people. We've been lucky so far.
You also work in farm succession planning. How is the current state of transferring the family farm to the next generation?
Well, I think it's slowed down a little because people are having a lot of financial issues. But we still have calls. We have people, obviously, that don't have debt. We have people that don't have very much debt. We have farmers getting older every day. So we have lots of calls saying, can you help us set up a transition plan? And what we can do is educate them on the plan, all the options that are available, so they can then take that to an attorney and draft up the kind of plan that they're looking for.
As we look at farming, lots of challenges. Are there things that you're hopeful about, things that make you hopeful for the future of the family farm?
Yes, definitely. I think we have the best educated, the best knowledge. We have the best farm managers producing the highest quality feed and fiber that we've ever had in this country. That's a positive. We see young people going into farming. And yes, it's tight right now and a struggle, but there's lots of optimism out there, too. The weather, people have fought weather for years. The weather will turn around. Milk prices going up. It needs to go up more. Grain prices have gone up. So there's a lot of positive out there within the negative. It's easy to always say, well, this is wrong and that is wrong. But there's farmers out there who are still turning a profit. I don't say that to insult the people who are struggling, because everybody had a different place they started in. Some people inherited farms. Some people were able to buy farms at a good price. Other people have had to pay the full market value. If they did that in 2015 and we've had 5 years of losses, that's pretty hard to get going.
Frank, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. And again,
Frank Fryer is an economic specialist with Wisconsin's Consumer Protection Agency. Coming up, it's news here on the Ideas Network. Oh, yeah, it's Independence Day, a fitting time to remember our history. And, hey, how did we get here anyway? It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And let's pause for a civics lessons. Drafting the Declaration of Independence, 1776, became the defining event in Thomas Jefferson's life. We're examining what was going on when the Declaration of Independence was approved by Congress in 1776, and we'll take in all the fascinating side stories leading up to this moment. What is your favorite piece of 4th of July history? How do you reconcile the past behaviors of our founding fathers and what we celebrate today? We're at 800-642-1234. Kenneth C. Davis is author of Don't Know Much About History and Don't Know Much About the American Presidents, among many other titles, and his website is don'tknowmuch.com. Ken, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. It is a great pleasure to be with you, and happy birthday, America.
Indeed.
Well, sort of.
And that's the thing, sort of. And I want to get to that sort of point. When people think about the 4th of July, they think about it being the day when we signed the Declaration of Independence. But apparently that's not so correct, is it?
Well, first of all, John Adams thought we would be celebrating 2 days ago, July 2nd. That was the date on which Congress actually voted in favor of a resolution of independence. Adams went home that night and wrote a letter to his lovely wife, Abigail, back in Massachusetts, saying this will be a day that will go down as the great feast day, and we'll have parades and bonfires and church bells tolling and illuminations, by which he meant kind of fireworks. And he was just off by 2 days, because it was on July 4th, after debating Jefferson's draft declaration for most of those 2 days, that Congress adopts, not signs, the Declaration of Independence. It was a vote. The document that was ready that day was Jefferson's handwritten draft, which had been scratched over and crossed out, a few words changed, a few words added, and a large paragraph taken out. So it's really that then it becomes it fixed in the American mind as the nation's birthday because of those words on July 4th, 1776, these United States of America, the first time that that phrase is used in a formal sense.
So between July 2nd and July 4th, in those 48 hours, what kind of debates were happening? What was going down behind closed doors?
Well, Jefferson, like all writers, speaking as one, didn't take kindly to being edited. He thought what he had written was pretty fine. He had actually drafted this over the course of several weeks, working on a portable desk of his own design, a wooden desk that he kept on basically on his knees. You could call it the original laptop. It is at the Smithsonian, and one can see it if they wished. So find Jefferson's writing desk. So he drafted this. He showed it to John Adams and Benjamin Franklin. They were two of the other five members of the committee that was supposed to draft this document, which was simply meant to explain why America was taking this rather extraordinary step and declaring itself independent. Jefferson's words were changed a little bit by Franklin and Adams. They made a few suggestions. Most famously, Franklin suggested that Jefferson change the words life, liberty, and the pursuit of property to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and I think we're all happy that he did. Then the Congress put its hands on it. They made a lot of changes, little word changes here and there, the addition of more references to a deity than Jefferson might have chosen, but he went along with that. But the biggest change was actually the most controversial in a sense, and it's the one we still have to focus on. Jefferson had written a paragraph that really excoriated slavery. Mm. Of course, ironic, coming from a slaveholder. Mm-hmm. And he blames the King of England for the slave trade and says the king is trying to prevent Americans from stopping the slave trade, which was actually not true, but this was a piece of propaganda as well as a piece of political philosophy. Congress took this out. Jefferson later says it was taken out in deference to those men who owned slaves, as well as those who were making a great deal of money transporting them. And, you know, this is the dark side of the story that we must come back to, that the nation that was conceived in liberty was also born in shackles. Because 41 of the 56 signers, at least, were either slaveholders themselves or participated in the slave trade. And that is the original sin of American history. And so we're trying to find a way to balance out what we celebrate with the reality of what slavery meant for 400 years in this country.
We're talking with Ken Davis, the author of Don't Know Much About History and Don't Know Much About the American Presidents, among other titles. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's a misconception you previously had about the 4th of July that you came to realize was completely false later on? What do you wish kids were learning in school about this history? You can call in or email ideas at WPR.org. Ken Davis, on this topic of slavery and knowing that 41 of 56 of these founding fathers had some element, some connection to slave trade, how long has it taken for us to really fully understand that connection and what connection these founding fathers had to slavery?
I think, unfortunately, we still don't understand that this is the hard history of our country. It's not well taught. People do have a sense, I believe, a great many people, that slavery is something that happened in one part of the country and not in the rest, and that it was a kind of sideshow to the proud pageant that we celebrate on the 4th of July. But we have to acknowledge that since 1619, that's 400 years ago, when the first Africans taken from Africa were sold into servitude in Jamestown, Virginia. This was part of the foundation of the nation and certainly part of the foundation of the Republic. It's written into the Constitution. It affected every aspect of American society, culture, and politics for most of those early years, and of course ultimately leads to the Civil War, the great tragedy in our history. So I don't think we fully come to terms with it in many ways. I think the recent flare-up when there was a congressional hearing just about establishing a commission to talk about reparations for slavery speaks to the kind of desire to wish this away and wish this didn't happen, but it did, and it continues to affect our politics and our society. So I think, you know, we can celebrate this day as this extraordinary birth of freedom and liberty and independence and the idea that we are all created equal and we have the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, but we still have work to do. And I think that that's an important thing. Look, democracy is under assault around the world in many places, and it's also eroded somewhat in our country. Democracy does not die in darkness. It often dies in broad daylight. And one of the things we must do is really understand our past and understand the sacrifices and the rights and responsibilities that come with that history.
Ken, when we look at those words, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, why did property get changed to happiness? And what's going on in Britain at this time and around property?
Well, it's an important word in 1776, because certainly when John Locke, who used the phrase or made the phrase most famous, an Enlightenment, English Enlightenment philosopher, who many of the founding fathers read a great deal, he talked about natural rights and the rights of man. Locke talks about property, and he's talking about it more in the sense that people would understand it generally, that most people in the European world at that time could own no property of their own. Most of the property belonged either to the king and the nobility or to the church. That was one of the reasons that so many people did start to come to America in the great immigration that followed for all those years. But by the time Thomas Jefferson writes the Declaration of Independence, property in America had a different connotation. And to many people at the time, property meant human property. Mm-hmm. And so that was certainly one of the reasons that Franklin suggests the change to happiness. I think it was also a sense of lifting the ideas to something higher. Now, Jefferson isn't writing happiness in the sense that, you know, we get from a puppy and good feeling, but a sense that a human being had the right to be happy in his life or her life, although Jefferson certainly wouldn't have thought about women too much in that respect. So it was an important idea and one of the radical ideas in the Declaration. You know, we sort of do take this for granted. We've grown up with it. We've said these words and heard these words for, as Americans, for more than 200 years now. But it was radical when Thomas Jefferson wrote these words. It was radical because the king was the most powerful. The king of England was the most powerful man, certainly in the Western world, the European world. And to say that every man was equal was an astonishing idea.
Radical.
It was radical. But I think that the most radical thing he said and wrote was that governments can only govern with the consent of the governed. Again, an idea we kind of take for granted is the essence of democracy, in a sense, representative democracy, that we must give our consent to the government. And that, more than anything, I think, really changed how people viewed their role in who was in charge of their lives. And that's why the Declaration stands today as not only an important document for Americans, but for people around the world.
Ken Davis, our guide through history, author of Don't Know Much About History and other titles. What questions do you have for our resident historian about the 4th of July and what happened in Philadelphia those 243 years ago? Where do these notions of national and self-determination come from? What was going through Thomas Jefferson's head? Ken has a hunch. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're celebrating the birth of our nation and asking, how did we get here? It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Celebrating the Declaration of Independence on July 4th is an American tradition, but what did the Founding Fathers actually have in for this fragile nation? On what issues did the founders most agree on? And what became of the 56 men who signed the Declaration? We're getting answers to these questions going inside the stories. Many other ones on your mind. Join in at 800-642-1234. Ken Davis is the author of Don't Know Much About, Fill in the Blank series, lots to do with history and presidents, and he stays with us for this look back 243 years ago. Ken, we were talking about these radical ideas and what the Founding Fathers had in mind in forming our country. Where did these notions of national self-determination really come from? What are their roots?
Well, there had been other republics throughout history, of course, and the founding fathers would always point to Rome, the Roman Republic, as their great model. And in fact, many of them would often trot around in togas, and they believed Cicero was the great Cicero and Cato and those who fought against Julius Caesar when he tried to bring down the republic. So these were ideas that were around for a long time in Western civilization, but certainly the Renaissance leading to the Enlightenment, this period where all basic questions that had been accepted for centuries in Europe were under fire. Science was coming to the fore. The view of the universe had changed. And so people were really thinking differently about people's place, mankind's place in that universe. And this period of enlightenment is incredibly important in shaping the views and the ideas of the founders, the idea that there were natural rights, questioning the divine monarchy. So this is a powerful moment in human history that culminates with Jefferson and other enlightenment philosophers, Franklin certainly among them, a man like Thomas Paine, an Englishman who comes to America and writes first Common Sense and then other pamphlets supporting the idea of a revolution. And of course, the English experiment that had been very slow in moving towards the power of Parliament being closer to an equal to the king. It certainly wasn't there yet in 1776, but this was a long, slow evolution, and Jefferson brings it to a complete fruition. But of course, again, we always have to balance it against this problem that we have, that this is a man who kept people as property, as Washington and 41 of the other signers of the Declaration did, and many other Americans.
Immigration has been a real through line through our nation's history, and tensions certainly running high on immigration today. How did the founding fathers think about immigrants coming to make a life here?
Well, it's an interesting question because we've always had this kind of dual view of immigrants, which is that the country was born of immigrants coming here for opportunity and in some cases religious freedom. But the facts don't always bear that out. You go back to 1750, before there was a United States of America, and one of the most famous founders in our history is worried about the immigrants coming into his state, his colony of Pennsylvania, colony at the time. He's worried because they speak their own language. They have the street signs and their business signs are in their language. They don't teach their children English. And he's worried about Germans. And this is Benjamin Franklin. So this fear that this wave of immigrants coming into the country and they would overwhelm the government and overwhelm the process that's been set up really predates and precedes the actual establishment of the country. The Continental Army is largely composed of recent immigrants, recent arrivals. There were many groups of soldiers in Washington's army who didn't speak English, primarily Germans and other Europeans. So this is the part of our history. We celebrate this idea of the melting pot, but it hasn't always been true. Once the country is established, of course, one of the first things that's passed is an Alien and Sedition Act that really sets the terms of who can come to the country and how long it will take to become a citizen. And every generation has thrown up its own version of Franklin's Germans. First, it was the French who were dangerous because they were all radicals and they were going to overthrow the government. Then it was the Irish because they were dirty, diseased, dangerous criminals who didn't speak the language. They were ignorant. They were bringing disease. And worst of all, they were Catholic, because that's part of the story here as well. There was tremendous antipathy towards Catholics in this country for much of our early history. Of course, everyone knows that John F. Kennedy was the first Roman Catholic president elected in 1960, but that doesn't speak to how really violent and vicious the attacks on Catholics were in this country for centuries before we got to that point. So all of the what we can talk about immigration and hold up as, you know, the proud history really doesn't bear out with what happens on the ground in our past. I had the experience the other day of going to the Statue of Liberty and to Ellis Island.
Nice.
And
yes.
Every American, I mean, it's such a remarkable and thrilling experience. Really advocate, if you come to New York, you must spend a few hours to go to these two places. First of all, most people don't realize that the Statue of Liberty is about liberty. At her feet are chains. She was given to the United States by France in honor of not immigration, but in honor of emancipation and the end of slavery. And that sort of narrative got written out of the Statue of Liberty's iconic image as welcoming foreigners. It was really built as a monument to liberty and the end of slavery in America.
When you see the Statue of Liberty today, does it give you the same feelings as when you saw it for the very first time?
For me personally,
yeah.
I get chills. We were with a park ranger, actually, as we were walking around, and at the backside of the Liberty, you look up and there's this towering figure. And I said to him, I don't know if he lives, works there every day. And he said, I don't know if you get tired of it, but I get chills just being here. And he said, no, it's the same for me every day I come to work. It is an extraordinary icon. But as I said, many people are not aware of the history of the statue and its a central role. It's called Liberty Enlightening the World.
I want to stop right there for just a moment because Gary in Bosco Bell would like to join us. Gary, hi.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Your guest has touched a little bit on slavery and a little bit on the violence used against Catholics and others. And I can't ever help not thinking about the Native Americans. And when Jefferson and the other founders structured that Declaration of Independence, in a way it was a death knell for about 10 million Native Americans that lived here. Killed were put on reservations and are still on reservations and living in poverty today.
Gary, thank you so much for the call. Ken, short on time, just a few words on Native Americans.
Well, Jefferson wrote them into the Declaration, and I can quote it here. He said, because he complained about the king, he has excited domestic insurrection amongst us and endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers the merciless Indian savages. Those are the words Jefferson uses to refer to Native Americans, and that was the view at the time. Just on the immigration question as well, because this is also in the Declaration, one of those parts that most Americans never read, he has endeavored, and that's again the king, this is a large list of charges against the king, he has endeavored to prevent the population of these states for that purpose, obstructing the laws for naturalization of foreigners, refusing to pass others to encourage their migration. So Jefferson was pro-immigration. The Declaration is a document about immigration.
Ken Davis, author of Don't Know Much About History, other titles as well. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.